better, I guess.
Yeah, you will. 40 years ago, a Hungarian professor of architecture invented a device that ruined my childhood. He didn't know it at the time, and when it was invented, neither did I. But after Christmas morning 1980, my life would never be the same again. It was that year, 6 years after it was invented, that Erno Rubik brought his magic puzzle to America, the Rubik's Cube. It is the most popular toy ever produced. More than 350 million have been sold. It has six faces, each a different color, and each face has nine little cubes. And to solve the puzzle, you must get all the colors aligned. All 54 tiny cubes must be in their place so that you see only solid color. Now that sounds easy. And mathematicians concur. Theoretically, they have discovered that the Rubik's Cube can be solved, no matter its configuration, in 20 turns or less. And in practice, the current world record confirms this. Dutchman Mats Valk solved the cube last year in 5.55 seconds. Not me. I worked on one for a year, beginning that Christmas morning in 1980, and the best I could do was solve three sides at once. I had been working on it all night, and when I realized I had half solved the conundrum, I was ecstatic. I burst into my parents' bedroom to show them, not realizing it was 4 in the morning. They were not as pleased with my accomplishment at that point as I was. Maybe it was their reaction that drained me of my enthusiasm for the puzzle. Most likely, I just gave up. And finally, I did what all my friends were doing who could not solve their Rubik's Cubes. I peeled the stickers off, and I put them all in the right place. And then I spent another year guarding the damn thing, so that no sibling or neighbor or friend or cousin would come and turn it, and I would lose the perfection once again. 20 turns or less? Not in my lifetime. I lack the brain power. I lack the patience. I don't have that geometric and spatial mind for such an exercise. And if I hadn't given up on the thing, I'm absolutely certain that I'd still be using my spare time twisting and turning that piece of plastic. I would waste my life attempting to sort out what cannot be sorted. And while others obviously can put it to rest in a few seconds, I would need a lifetime. There are some puzzles that simply cannot be solved. We don't have the ability. We don't have the time. These puzzles usually come in the form of a question. Why? Why did one so young, so full of life, have to die so soon? Why did one so giving, so honest and good, have to be struck with some crippling disease? Why did the storm have to hit that neighborhood? Why did the bullet have to ricochet into that body? Why do I have to be alone or childless or sick when there are people far more evil than me, and God, I can point them out to you if you need me to, and they lived a charmed life? Job's eternal question, why do the wicked prosper while the righteous suffer? So we twist and we turn and we lose sleep and we lose years in the process trying to find answers, when the better part of wisdom might be to put the thing down and get on with living the life we have, in spite of the unsolvable puzzles, rather than obsessing over what we can do nothing about. Death, unjustified suffering, a silent heaven when we pray. Things like this are as common as humankind. If you are perplexed by these things, you are not alone. It is the journey of faith to navigate such swamplands of the soul. That's how James Hollis describes these. But in my experience, one word would capture most of the deep riddles that people struggle with. One word. Yesterday. For every person who is wrestling with what is happening in their life today, for every person anxious about what might happen tomorrow, there are a dozen people stuck in what happened yesterday. Isn't that where all our whys come from? Isn't it our past that creates these question marks? Isn't a maddening Rubik's Cube an accurate metaphor for how most of us live? We take this thing and we work it over and over and over again, getting nowhere, but we can't seem to let it go, and there is no peel and re-stick solution. Yet we feel it must be solved. Other people can do it. Why can't we? There's this beautiful prose in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 43, 18 and 19. But before I read it, a quick note. The prophet Isaiah was a holy man, an advisor to the Jewish kings, a prolific writer who lived about 700 years before Jesus. At the time, the Assyrian Empire was on the rise as the world's first genuine superpower. And if you were to look at a map today, just look at where all the trouble is today, and you'll know where the Assyrian Empire was. It possessed all of Syria, all of Jordan, all of western Iraq, and part of Turkey. They were an unstoppable, consuming force and exceptionally cruel. Some of that legacy seems to live on. They set their sights finally on Egypt, Palestine, and Israel. And for 39 chapters, Isaiah warns his countrymen that a disaster is coming. And they need to heed his warning. They do not. The disaster comes. Half of Israel is obliterated. But then in chapter 40, right in the middle of the book, the mood and the temperament changes. In the second half, the book is directed at those few exiles who survived this Holocaust. The prophet doesn't challenge them to change their ways. The trouble had already come and gone, and nothing could be done about it now. Now he speaks to give them hope. The second half of Isaiah is written to push a group of people out of their painful past and into the future. And this text sums up this hope from the New International Version. God speaking through the prophet. Forget the former things. Do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wastelands. When it comes to making some peace with the past, whether it is something we have suffered, something inflicted upon us, or some mistake we have made, we cannot ask the question, why did this happen? Because God is asking us the question, can't you see what I'm doing? Do you not perceive it? I've paved a road out of the deadness of your past, and what was nothing but a desert and bad lands has become a lush, green, productive landscape. That is what lies out ahead of you. But you can't see it, you'll never see it, if you are always looking over your shoulder at the past. I took Bryce for his first driving lesson not too many days ago before he left for the summer. It was a 3-mile journey from the pizza place to home. Low risk. Only one left turn. Everything else was a right turn. That's important when a 15-year-old is behind the wheel. He did just fine for the first mile or so. And then a car got behind him. And as is the case, this new driver was moving at the speed limit. The driver behind him was not and was tailgating severely. And I told Bryce, pay no mind to the car behind you. it can affect your driving. No sooner had I got those words out of my mouth, he does this. Doesn't glance in the mirror, doesn't check the sides, 180 degrees, turns and looks at the car behind him. Is it any wonder why some of us can't keep our lives on track? Is it any wonder why we keep ending up in the ditch? When we are constantly looking out the back window at the past, what else could happen? The road, the future, your life is out in front of you. Do you not perceive it? Can't you see it? Life is always moving forward, and that is where God is leading. Let me revisit the Rubik's Cube. This is almost impossible to believe, but there are, according to that evil man Erno Rubik himself, 43 quintillion ways to scramble a Rubik's Cube. That's the number 43, followed by 18 zeros. By this logic, if you turn the cube one turn every second, it would take you 1,500 trillion years to go through every permutation. I guess I should take comfort that I gave only away a year of my life. Or two, guarding it for a year. When you look at it like that, it makes perfect sense to give up on solving some of your problems. You will spend your whole life doing what a good therapist would call navel gazing. Obsessing with yourself. Obsessing with your own past, your own pain, your own problems. So self-absorbed that you not only give away the future, you give away what little time you have that's called today. Consider the original recipients of Isaiah's words. I've already mentioned that you can divide this book into two halves. It's likely that the original Isaiah wrote the first half, but a second person using Isaiah's name and his reputation wrote the second half. Because the book is too long for one person to have witnessed it all. The events that take place in the second half of the book are nearly 100 years after the first half of the book. Isaiah must have been something if he could live that long. That's why there is a mood change in the middle of the book. And it's not just academic trivia. This means that multiple generations had lived and died far from home from when the trouble struck the land and when these words were finally jotted down. These words were written to a group of people who had never even lived in Israel. Written to a group of people that had never even worshipped at the Jewish temple. Written to a group of people who had never set foot in the iconic land of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And going further, this is so very important. They weren't to blame for what had happened to them. They weren't even alive when it took place. Nor were their parents. That was their grandparents and their great-grandparents that had sown all that trouble. And here they are, generations removed, and they are bearing the responsibility and the shame for something they were not even responsible for. That describes so many of us. We carry around very real suffering, deep, crippling, emotional suffering from yesterday that was inflicted upon us. We did not cause it. Abuse or tragedy in our family of origin. Betrayal by unfaithfulness or addiction. Backed into a corner where we had to make impossible decisions and there was no possibility of a good outcome. Shoddy business partners. Psychotic ex-husbands and ex-wives. The ill-fated timing of a bad economy. Inexplicable illness suffered personally or by one we love. We feel victimized by what others have done to us, by being in the wrong place at the wrong time, susceptible to genetics, or simply the fickle finger of fate dealt us a raw deal. We didn't do it, but we bear the past as if we did. And even when we are suffering from self-inflicted wounds, have you ever suffered because of something you did? No. When we make foolish choices, we have to learn to grant ourselves a little grace. The person who made those bad decisions in the past, that person might share your name, but that person back there and the person living today are two very different animals. Given the chance to do a do-over, we would all act differently, but at the time we made the only decisions we were capable of making. And the person we are today is suffering at the hands of the foolish person we used to be. But we are not that person anymore. So cut yourself some slack. Forgive yourself of your own past and get on with it. Get on with today. Get on with traveling that road that God is creating to your future. Do you not perceive it? Can you not see it? It is there. You only have to quit looking over your shoulder. You only have to lift your head from the puzzle you keep trying so hard to solve. And then you'll see that life is waiting for you to live it. I'll finish today by telling the story of Flagstaff, not Arizona, Flagstaff, Maine. The first major military campaign during the Revolutionary War did not take place in what would become U.S. soil. The Continental Army actually invaded in 1775 British Quebec. So when the Army left New England and headed north toward Canada, they paused in western Maine to make a little riverside campsite. They raised a flagpole over their new campsite, and it became known as Flagstaff, 100 years before the town in Arizona. It became a permanent town. But in 1928, the Maine legislature passed a bill approving the construction of a dam in that river valley to produce electricity. It would produce Flagstaff Lake, 22,000 acres of water, and it would also drown the village of Flagstaff. This happened all over the country in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. As the power company bought up all the property, a few of Flagstaff's residents dug in. They would not move or be moved. And meanwhile, everything and everyone around them continued to move toward the future. Families moved out and moved on. The school closed. Businesses locked their doors and relocated. City Hall was disassembled. Churches were yanked from their foundations and moved to higher ground. Roads and infrastructure were given up on. Even the dead were exhumed and reburied in other places. And then there were those who clung to the past, resisting what they could do nothing about. And they held on for 20 years. 2 decades of dying. 2 decades of fussing and fighting and litigating over how wrong they were treated. 20 years of staying stuck. Forget the former things. Do not dwell on the past. I am doing a new thing. Can you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams falling from the sky right now in the wastelands. Let us pray.